thank you again for coming out. I cannot get over what a unique and wonderful thing you've got going here. Honestly, there's nothing like it that I know of in the country. So you here in Billings. No, it's true. I mean, Dick has got like the events, the quality of events are absolutely unique and world class. Let me see. Is this going to work? It was working. There we go. Okay. Excuse me while I get set up a little bit. So last night, if you were here, we talked a little bit about... my coffee is not finished. Maybe? There we go. All right, now we're set. We talked a little bit about the basis, the theological basis for the sexual revolution, why Satan hates marriage and the family so much, why he hates the reproductive function of women and motherhood so much, and some of the explicitly satanic attacks that he has taken throughout history. And particularly, we focused on the last 500 years since the Enlightenment, which has been the basis for modernism, really. Satan wants to treat us and make us act more like animals, I argued in my first talk, rather than people. That God distinguishes those created in the image of God, us, from the rest of his creation in animal form and animals. And the big lie was, Satan in the garden said, you shall be like God, when in fact we became more like animals. And it has to do with freedom, right? We no longer have the freedom that we should, that we were created with as people in the image of God, to make all the best decisions. Now we are a little bit more influenced by our animal desires. And this was the big lie. And so we talked about some of the more explicitly satanic spiritualist attacks last night. And if you missed it, Dick has those online very quickly, if not already. But that's not the only way he sells that lie. Because we're not all, in the modern era, we're not all spiritualists. Some people did take that tact, right? After the chaos, the epistemic crisis of the Reformation and the Enlightenment, we had people trying to grasp for, how do I know what I know, right? And the Bible was just not sufficient for some, right? It led to, well, the Bible's not sufficient, so I'm going to use my head, or I'm going to use my heart. We talked more about the heart aspect last night, the romantics, right? Well, this morning, we're going to talk more about the rationalist side, the people who said, no, I'm not only am I not just going to use my head, but nothing else. No spiritual aspect to life. The materialists. So the Satanists, on one sense, were more honest, I would say, about what was going on. They accepted the same lie, but they're more honest. But this side looks more at the materialist side. A couple things I noticed as I study. So I teach history. I love history. Study a lot of it. And the follow the science thing that we have had for the past few years. And I don't, as a Gen Xer myself, and I know we've got some Gen X, it seems like the older we are, the more we generally trust the science, and the younger we get, the more skeptical we are. And as a Gen Xer, I'm generally pretty skeptical of everything. So when you tell me to trust the science, I generally don't. Unfortunately, many do, and we have a long tradition of it, okay? The two strains of the revolution, the rebellion against God, they wanted the same thing. They wanted freedom to control reality. The satanic, more spiritualist side said, I will do it through magic, and I will control reality through hexes and spells and more spiritual side. The materialist side said, I will control nature through science, and I will use technology, and I will look at all of reality as materialistic, but my goal is the same. I want to control it. I want it to do so it can serve me. Because the goal, of course, is freedom, right? We talked about the modernistic understanding of freedom last night is libertarian freedom, which is the ability to not be controlled by anything. Anything that constricts me and I didn't choose, I need to be able to overcome. I need to be able to revolt against it, to be my own person, to be free. So the magicians say, I'm going to cast a spell, but the materialists say, I will build some sort of tech, or I will figure out how to transform reality to make it do what I want to do. Okay. And so this can be kind of handy for like building dams, hydroelectric power, like controlling matter for our own good. I mean, that's kind of handy. Well, I live in Southern California and we get powered by all the amazing tech that people built in the early 20th century, right? On the other hand, that mindset can go a little too far. And so America has had plenty of both. We've had plenty. We talked last night about the spiritualists. This morning, we're going to talk more about the materialists and the scientists and ultimately how they come together. At the end, if I don't remind me at the end, but if I don't tell you about C.S. Lewis and the abolition of man and his great story called That Hideous Strength, he brings the magicians and the applied scientists together in an amazing fictional story that is perfect for our modern age because they're after the same thing, to be free to do what I want, to be my own God. So let's start real briefly. We're going to go through this very quickly. Some of this will be familiar ground, but what I want to point out is that the science is not actually usually science. That there's good, you know, like studying and the scientific method, I mean, nothing wrong with that, right? We want to be able to study reality and understand it. On the other hand, the scientists that I'm going to talk about either twist the science and lie about it, or do the science in a very unethical way, shall we say. So let's start with one of the godfathers of this, Charles Darwin. Of course, we're all familiar with evolutionary theory. I'm sure we've talked about it many times here at the forum. He basically gave a plausible mechanism to atheistic naturalism, right? Like you could have been an atheist before, but this gave you a story to go with it. But it led directly to a whole lot of evil, all right? A whole lot of evil. In that when you can explicitly, now think about what Darwin said, that when you can explicitly say, not only should we, you know, look at you like animals, but you are an animal. You are nothing more than an animal. There is no spiritual dimension to you. There's no image of God anywhere close. You're just another rutting animal, ultimately, right? He's just very explicit about it. Did he see? He saw a little bit where this was going to go, what it would do to morals, what it would do to our view of the dignity of man. Racism got a lot worse in the world after Darwin's theory because now we could apply a scientific genetic explanation for why we're oppressing somebody of a different skin color, which before we kind of had to, you know, make some bad theology up about that, make some bad philosophy up. Now we're like, oh no, I mean, the Africans are just genetically inferior or whatever, right? So the eugenics movement gets a big boost after Darwin, because now we have superior races and inferior races. But it's all bogus, right? It's all bogus science. Evolution, macroevolution at least, and of course, you guys know a lot of people from the Discovery Institute, they do a lot of great work on this, but macroevolution is just junk science. There's really no evidence for it. It's not scientific. Maybe microevolution a little bit in some cases. But what Darwin's theory has done to society, it's completely faux. We don't need to accept any of it. Okay, it's all a big lie. Understanding that gets us a long ways, right? Realize that the whole thing is a house of cards. You're based on one big anti-scientific lie. But Darwin then leads to, and again, we're going to go through this very quickly, but he leads the materialist view of the world combined with Enlightenment rationalism and trying to figure out what are people, what is the nature of our relationships, how do we get along, and in the midst of, by the way, a lot of injustice. We talked about the state of society in the mid-19th century. It wasn't great, right? There was a lot of oppression. Like, women were in trouble. There was a lot of children in factories and this, like a lot of bad things were happening. But from a materialist worldview then, it becomes very hard to figure out what to do about that. And the scientific answer is always a lie. Marx and Engels, I mean, it's hard, you know, it's hard to say who's done more, you know, worse to the world. Darwin, Marx and Engels, Freud, we're going to talk about in a second. Like, these guys did so much damage with their theories. But they see the world as an economic battle and the family as a capitalist tool to advance the desires of the powerful. Extremely anti-family because the family is the oppressor, right? They see the world in economic terms, materialist and economic terms. But again, what's the goal? Freedom to do what I want. And the thing that's keeping me from doing what I want is the family structure. So we need to get away from that. French Marxist philosopher Louis Althusser argued that the family is just another element of the ideological state apparatus, which is used to socialize the proletariat into capitalist values. He says the family teaches us obedience and gender roles, which are all reflected in the workplace, and we need to get rid of all of those, right? We need to get rid of all of the socialization that happens with the family because it's just pressing capitalism, and capitalism is oppressive, and we need freedom, right? It's all about freedom. We're just adding a scientific gloss to it now. Also, they talk about the family as a unit of consumption, that families are encouraged to keep up with the Joneses. There actually is some validity to this one, by the way. The feminist movement took off quite a bit. We'll talk about Betty Friedan in a second. After the Second World War in America, where all of those companies that had been funding the war machine and making a lot of stuff, they moved that into things like washing machines, and they've got to continue to sell. And one of the ways they tried to sell was a big propaganda machine to keep women happy in their kitchen full of appliances, right? And women naturally rebelled against that because, frankly, they should have. I mean, it was a propaganda thing to make money. That was after Marx, but that idea that, are women just a consumer, scheme? No. However, again, you can't apply the materialist Marxist philosophy to that. It just leads to the breakdown of the family. So, I mean, communism is a disaster that killed millions and millions. I mean, it's hard to overstate, again, the evil of communism. It's also hard to overstate the evil of this guy. I mean, this guy did unbelievable damage to the world. Sigmund Freud, father of psychoanalysis, his idea, he took Darwinian materialism and the idea that we're all running animals really, really seriously, and posited that, in fact, all of our problems were the result of a repressed sex drive. Now, think about it. Like, God creates us as human beings so that we can control our impulses, right? We can control our passions. And that man and wife come together to freely give of themselves exclusively to that person, because that's the only place, a married family couple is really the only place that you can fully give and trust and be the image of God. The opposite of that is to be the animal that gives into every sex drive that you have without any self-control. And that's explicitly what Freud wanted. He said all of our problems, all of the social issues we have are because we have repressed our sex drive. And if we could just have more orgasms, to be frank about it, everybody would be fine. The world would get along, and we would have utopia. We would have peace. This is a complete, even in psychoanalysis, he's looked at kind of as a quack now, unfortunately, right? Like, everybody's Freudian, though, still, just not the counselors. It's quack science. It's absolutely nonsense. Psychoanalysis is just a big con. It's complete garbage science. The idea that we're all driving every single thing that we do based on wanting to have sex with people, basically, right? Well, if this is the case, by the way, he said that if you are, basically the meaning of life is orgasm, and all pathologies are the result of repressed sexual energy, who does that apply to? Because, think about this is a very dangerous thing that we're going to see come up again and again. If the meaning of life is orgasm and all of our problems are from repressed sexual energy, that has to apply to everyone. Otherwise, think of like normally we would have thought the meaning of life is love. And as you grow and mature and learn how to give of yourselves and control your impulses, then you can grow up and get married and live that out. But if the meaning of life is to release your inhibitions, it has to apply to everybody, including children, right? Because otherwise, what? Does the meaning of life start when you reach adolescence? Does the meaning of life start when you're adult? What's the meaning of life for children? That doesn't make any sense. So they had to apply that all the way down to babies. And so Freud actually took a big effort trying to convince everyone that babies are sexual. And we're going to see more and more of that through the 20th century. The disgusting sexualization of children is a direct result of this worldview that says the meaning of life is sex. He says, basically, we're not living enough like animals. Society has built up religion and institutions to keep us, to oppress us. Remember, we want liberty to keep us from our individual pleasure. Well, Freud, you know, he actually had less... Again, Freudian ideas come to America and take off more so than Europe. He was kind of dismissed as a nutcase in Europe many times. So we need a little bit more science to support Freud. And along comes our friend Margaret Mead, who offers some cultural anthropology and psychology science to support the theories of Freud. Margaret Mead is still to this day the world's most famous cultural anthropologist. She basically made that realm of science popular. In 1928, she published the book Coming of Age in Samoa, which ostensibly was the story of her going to the Samoan Islands and studying the indigenous cultures there and seeing just how happy they were and how much better they were than the West, because she claimed they just had a lot of sex. Young girls had a lot of sex, and they were just so happy and well-adjusted. And everybody, there was no marriage to say, people just exchanged partners. And it was, like the Oneida community before, a sexual paradise and everyone was happy. She published it. The culture ate it up. Coming of Age Samoa was an extremely popular book, heralded by the American press as a masterpiece. It became the most popular anthropological work in history. To this day, Margaret Mead, I mean, you could have seen her on TV in the early 2000s, right? I mean, she was the basis for an entire industry saying that, yeah, kids need to have more sex. I saw a show just the other night where there's still, you know, the parent and the teen comes in. He's like, oh, my girlfriend's staying over tonight. And the parent just like nods, all right, see ya. It's fine, right? And where does that idea come from? Well, I mean, kids are going to have sex. We should have sex, right? Unfortunately, it was all bogus. I mean, she made it all up. It was a complete lie, the whole story. The Samoans weren't like that. They have a very familial culture. They have very strong sexual ethics. It was a complete sham. And it took until, though, 1983 for it to come through. Derek Freeman wrote a great book debunking Mead. Of course, the press ignored it. But it was a complete sham. It's fake science. It's propaganda. She literally made it up. But she's the woman who has her face on a postage stamp. You can get a Margaret Mead postage stamp. She was Time Woman of the Year. Oh, by the way, she was a bisexual who had several liaisons, no rough family background, as they all do, by the way, right? Then we go to, and if you've read Truman's book, yeah, he brings up Reich quite a bit, which is great. Wilhelm Reich, again, hardcore Freudian. When he was 10, his father discovered his mother having an affair and beat her over a long period of time until she repeatedly tried to kill herself and was eventually successful. That was Freud's background. They all come out of bad family backgrounds. But he was a hardcore disciple of Freud, and he also believed that orgasms could save the world, only he took it to a next level. It's kind of like the prequel Star Wars movies. If you understand Star Wars at all, the prequel movies that came out in the late 90s, terrible, terrible movies. But one thing George Lucas did was try to give a materialist gloss to his Star Wars theology from the 70s and 80s, where you had the Force, there was this living, breathing thing that inhabited all people. And then in the 90s, they come out and say, well, that's midichlorians. That's like these little things, these little material things that are in people. It was a materialist explanation for a spiritual thing. That's kind of what happens with the sexual revolution when you come to the materialist side of it. Because Wilhelm Reich also believed that orgasms would save the world and that repressed energy was the problem. He just literally thought there was energy molecules and things floating around in the air that were sexual. And if you could harness those, not only would you have better orgasms, but you would release energy into the world and bring world peace. Like, he literally thought that scientifically that's what could happen. In fact, he built what he called an orgone box, which was just, some of them are about that size, if you feel like four walls like that, and put a box, he would sell them to people, they would get in, and the idea was that you'd have better orgasms in this box, and that in doing so, you would release energy into the world to literally bring world peace. So this is another one of those where he ran into trouble in Europe, and he brought his ideas to America and started, like the snake oil salesman of before, post-World War II, started traveling America selling orgone boxes and became very famous at it. Okay, he was a very popular guy, especially among like the Beat Generation. If you've read Jack Kerouac's On the Road, which probably most of your high schoolers still have to read in high school, absolutely terrible book about Jack Kerouac traveling around on road trips in the 50s just to have random sex with people. But the orgone box pops up there because that friend, so you had like William Burroughs, the poet, all those guys in the 50s, the Beat Generation, they thought that Wilhelm Reich was the only philosopher worth listening to. They absolutely had orgone boxes. If you go down to Monterey in that area, which is where they set up some of their Beat poetry, and Burroughs was there, you can to this day go and see an orgone box sitting there. Absolutely nonsense science. The FDA eventually arrested him and made him chop up his orgone boxes for false advertising. The FDA's a lot of sham stuff too, but in this they were actually like trying to protect consumers. But check this out. So they made Reich chop up his orgone boxes with axes, which he did. But then he actually, and an offensive side is, he laid an American flag over it and said, you are keeping me from my liberty. He put the whole revolution thing that we need to be free. He was one of the few books that got burned, but it was a very famous book. His book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, we'll talk about it a little bit later, actually maybe in the next talk. But he was a major influence and majorly popular with that 60s generation. The student revolutionaries in 1968 threw copies of The Mass Psychology of Fascism against, and they hurled the books and said, read Reich and act accordingly, was their slogan to some of those student protesters. Absolute hero of the Bohemian set. In fact, Time magazine, let's just show you how influential. This was the cover of Time, January 24th, 1963. And this was one quote from the article. For now, it sometimes seems that all America is one big orgone box. With today's model, it's no longer necessary to sit in cramped quarters for a specific time. Improved and enlarged to encompass the continent, the big machine works on its subjects continuously day and night. From innumerable screens and stages, posters and pages, it flashes the larger-than-life images of sex. From countless racks and shelves, it pushes the books, which a few years ago were considered pornography. From myriad loudspeakers, it broadcasts the words and rhythms of pop music erotica, and constantly over the intellectual muzak comes the message that sex will save you and libido will set you free. This is exactly what we've been saying all week. Time understood it. They had better editors back then. They actually, this is 1963, and they had a pretty accurate view of what was happening. So times that by a million, and we got where we are today. But in 63, they saw it. They're like, all of America has become one big orgasm accumulator. Like, what are we doing here? Just to give you a snapshot. All right, we got to back up a few years to another fake science propaganda person, Margaret Sanger, major force in the early 20th century, also major Freudian. She, too, believed that sexual energy would save the world. She absolutely subscribed to it. Absolutely terrible person in general. Had multiple affairs, abandoned her children that she had, romped around Europe and America, having as much sex as possible. She's also the world's premier advocate for birth control. She thought that this was the key because, of course, as we talked about with the Oneida community, free sex provides babies, and there's got to be some way to stop that. You have to be able to fight against a female body if you're going to pull this off. And so the body becomes the next stage of our revolution movement, where somehow I have to overcome it. How am I going to do that? I'm going to use science. And so eventually, Margaret Sanger works with guys like Gregory Pincus and a few others to synthetically develop hormones that will stop women from getting pregnant. Also, by the way, at the same time, they did the world's first sex change operation and gave cross-sex hormones, same thing, synthetic hormones, to a soldier, which was a kind of a famous thing back, kind of a one-off. But notice the same thing is happening. You are giving cross-sex hormones to stop the body's natural function. The birth control pill and contraception in general, especially through Sanger's view, is the very clear precursor to the transgender phenomenon. We'll emphasize that a little bit more next talk. But what she is doing is scientifically trying to defeat nature. The war against reality is definitely a war against the woman's body. But it's also a lot of really bad science and a lot of fake propaganda. So when they were testing these synthetic pills, they actually weren't, they didn't want to do it in America in case there was bad press. They sent a bunch of the drugs down to Puerto Rico and ended up killing a whole bunch of women because they were trying to figure out the testing, how much can women handle. And so dozens of women were killed, many more, all sorts of cancers come. In fact, there was in 1960, eight or nine, Barbara Seaman wrote The Doctor's Case Against the Pill and was very influential in trying to get it regulated a bit more. I would argue that the pill is all bad science. And I know that this is another one of those issues where I'll just be frank, Protestants see it as a Catholic thing. It shouldn't be a Catholic thing. Up until 1930, Dick mentioned this yesterday, up until 1930, this was the one topic on which all Christians of all denominations absolutely agreed. Like all the reformers, every Protestant sect, they all agreed that contraception was a grave evil because it defeats women's natural function and motherhood, and that as such, we should not do that. Margaret Sanger actually got in, I'll say she got in bed metaphorically, probably sometimes literally, with several preachers in the country, and they would have like a sermon contest to see who could preach the best pro-contraception pill. They'd have national contests. And she got a few of the more left-leaning pastors in the country. And finally, the Anglicans in Britain, the Lambeth Conference in 1930 was the first Christian denomination in the whole world to formally approve birth control, and then only in specific cases, and then only, but of course, the floodgates opened. The birth control pill and Margaret Sanger unleashed evil on the world. You think, why, if we had all of this in the 19th century, I talked about last night, why did it not really explode until the 60s? Like, why do we usually think about the 60s as the sexual revolution? Because the pill came on board in 1960. Okay? The pill gave contraception. I mean, the Oneida community, they had a bunch of like methods for not creating babies, but they're not very effective. The science, here's a bad use of science. The science and the technology enabled then contraception to be widely accepted countrywide, nationwide. Millions and millions of women got on it almost instantly. And that's when the sexual revolution really takes off, because now we have scientific support, the tech, to make it possible. Notice this was her first newsletter back in the early, like 20s. The pro-contraception movement. Notice its title, The Woman Rebel, No Gods, No Masters. She's just very explicit about it, right? This is the same theory that we've had the whole time. No gods, no masters for me. We want to be free. I want to be a rebel. I'm a revolutionary. Same theme. Here's another very evil dude, Alfred Kinsey, sexual pervert. He brought the scientific support for the sexual revolution in a couple of books, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Also, I mean, you can't sort of grasp, I think, how popular these books were, how many hundreds of thousands of copies they were sold, how much press they are getting. The basic gist of both of these books is that America at the time, so this would have been 30s, 40s, 50s, wasn't as Puritan as everybody thought. He claimed to do a sociological survey of America and come away with surprising stats. Stats like most, like a third of young men practice homosexual behavior, sometimes with animals, and that most women are adulterous and have affairs. He came up with stats like, and this one's constantly, 10% of people are gay. I grew up with that stat in school. That was like a, it was just told like, oh yeah, of course, 10% of the people are gay. Well, what he didn't tell us is that all of that was junk science. Basically, he did do a bit of surveys and he did do some extremely evil experiments, sometimes on babies. But most of his sociological study, he went to prisons and he interviewed prostitutes. If you look at the, like sociologically, who provided the data for these studies, it was pedophiles and sex perverts and prostitutes. This wasn't some sort of snapshot of modern, you know, like contemporary America. It was a very specific group to skew the data. And again, it wasn't until decades later, and even today, I mean, you can go to the University of Indiana today to the Kinsey Institute. The guy has shown to, you won't be able to see all his, they have all of his papers, but they won't let you see them all if you go to the University of Indiana, because some of his papers do show experiments that he hired to have done to, and I'm sorry, I hope there's no young children in the room, but he would do experiments on babies to see if you could bring babies to orgasm. He's taking Freud to the next level, and so he would very scientifically write it down to see. Again, trying to find scientific support, but it's just all lies and propaganda and abusing people to get it done. In fact, he himself, I would say, was a violent sexual abuser, had all sorts of diseases. But his reputation, I mean, today, Liam Neeson played Kinsey in a movie, a puff piece movie, I think it was about 2015. I mean, not that long ago, okay? This guy, all of your sex ed in school, by the way, is pushed out generally through the Kinsey Institute. I mean, they're the ones that started sex ed in public education. And the material is provided now. Now a lot of the material is provided by Planned Parenthood, which was Sanger's. That's where Sanger went, right? She started her birth control practice, went to Planned Parenthood. But again, fake junk science that should not be believed. I want to do a couple just more explicitly propaganda people, not so much science, but propaganda. Hugh Hefner, founder of Playboy, another big Kinseyan, loved Kinsey, right? This is great. But he took that data and sold the subjugation and exploitation of women as a sophisticated lifestyle choice, right? The era of James Bond and cool and rich and I'm so happy. And yeah, women love to be treated like what? Bunnies. Bunnies. Why bunnies? Because can you think of a rutting animal that has more sex than bunnies? Right? It's just so disgusting. But that's exact. I mean, they're just very clear about it. Yeah, we treat you like animals. Yeah, I have a whole herd of bunnies surrounding me, providing me sexual favors, whatever. It's just so exploitive and so objectifying. Yet, Hefner was able to sell it as the cool, sophisticated choice for young men. What? I mean, on a propaganda level, it's pretty amazing. I have a podcast, by the way, that you can find. It's called American Lies. I don't have that many episodes, but one, I do an episode about propaganda. And Edward Bernays, this is not even in my talk, but Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Freud, by the way, they're all connected. Edward Bernays came out of World War II and mastered public relations and propaganda. And it's an amazing story. I encourage you to go listen to it. But Hefner and these guys mastered that, like selling objectively evil stuff that is hurting people as good. And so Playboy became a huge success. Another quick one on another Kinsey disciple and a pedophilia advocate, John Money. He did one of the most disgusting experiments and founded one of the most fraudulent institutions in the history of America, the John Hopkins Gender Identity Clinic, where he claimed to do sex changes. Well, if you were here to listen to Walt not that long ago, I'm sure he mentioned this. There is no such thing as a sex change operation. You can mutilate people's bodies, but nobody changes anybody's sex. But he claimed to do that. And Johns Hopkins, which is the most prestigious thing you can find in America scientifically, we're just following the science here, aren't we? No, he's doing experiments. He did an experiment on a guy named James Reimer. The kid was twins. There was the Reimer boys, and the one accidentally, during circumcision, had his genitals mutilated, and so John Money convinced the parents to let him do an experiment. Why don't we raise him as a girl and see if sex is socially constructed and not biological, right? They're trying to do a scientific thing to start scientifically transgendering people, if that's possible. Absolute disaster. James Reimer ends up committing suicide after a lifetime of pain and heartache. Yet, the Johns Hopkins Institute, it actually shut down doing sex change operations for a while, but then it has started back up more recently with the new explosion of transgender. But again, fake science, false studies. Back up a few years to another, the mother of the second wave feminist movement again, but I don't buy the first, second wave stuff. I think it's all the same. But Betty Friedan offered a scientific sociological explanation for why women should not focus on getting married and raising children. Because she says, when you do that, you just get bored and depressed. And she based that theory on a study she did of housewives in America. She said, I went out there, I talked to them, and they have a problem. It's a problem with no name. But I think what it is, and then she wrote The Feminine Mystique to describe what it was, and she says, basically, they're not out making their own money. They're not out having the jobs that men do. They don't have the power that men do. That's the problem. They're home with their kids. So they should be out making money. And if they would, that would give them happiness. But what she didn't really explain was her study was based on her talking to a couple of her friends that she went to school with at Smith College. So highly educated, older women who, by the way, had already raised their kids and were out of the house and were now sitting at home in their post-World War II consumerist, boring life, admittedly, okay? But that does not prove that women should not get married or have kids and go make money, right? This is a couple of her highly educated, working women, by the way, who said, oh yeah, I think I am bored when I'm at home. There's nothing to do there, right? Complete nonsense, complete fake science. But the feminine mystique was a cultural turning point. I mean, a massive, massive book. She ended up founding the National Organization for Women, major push in 19, like the whole feminist movement of 68, where you see women burning their bras and that gets into the abortion movement and that whole thing. Friedan is right there. She's the one you'll see on the front lines of all those pickets for those pictures from 68 to 69 and throughout. But again, it's all based on a lie. Friedan had a strongly Marxist background. David Horowitz, I think it was, wrote a good book about Friedan not a while back. A strongly Marxist, politically driven worldview that she tries to support sociologically. Along with, here's this guy, Larry Lader. So he, initially Friedan was a little apprehensive about the whole abortion thing, but Lader convinced Friedan that she needed the National Organization for Women to be pro-abortion. So how did he do that? Well, he wrote a book literally called Abortion, which was considered the scientific, sociological book to support this abhorrent practice. In fact, Roe versus Wade quotes it 8 times to support their decision. Like, well, Lader did the research. He looked at it. It purports to show the history of abortion and the current state of abortion in America at the time. So, for example, he says, oh, there's 100,000 abortions that happen back alley, like coat hanger abortions every year in this country. Well, what came out later? is that his he did this with his friend and partner. Let me catch up on my notes here. Freestyling way too much. You shouldn't do that. Bernard Nathanson, who later repented after doing tens of thousands of abortions and became a Christian and wrote a great book about it. And Nathanson admitted, we made all that up. There was no stats. There was no numbers. There was maybe 300. We said 100,000. He just made up numbers out of thin air. The history of abortion that they wrote in abortion, absolutely bogus. Oh, there was so much abortion in the, you know, Middle Ages and the Catholic Church was doing it. No, it was all made up, okay? Yet this is how we got Roe versus Wade, because, well, we just got to follow the science. No, they're lies, okay? It's complete garbage. Nathanson's book is good on this. There was so much bad science happening during this time. Paul Ehrlich, same time, 1968, publishes The Population Bomb, based on the bad science of a guy named Malthus from back in the 1800s, who looked around and said, oh, food, if we don't have enough food, people will die. And so as population goes up, we're going to have less food. And then what's going to happen? So there must be like a balance between food and numbers. And if we go too high on the numbers, we'll have mass starvation and everyone will die, right? That was Malthus's scientific theory. Complete nonsense. Okay, you guys are ranchers and farmers, I can tell from some. You guys know how farming works. Technology advances, and you can get a lot more food out of ground much more today than you used to. Just because the population grows up, goes higher, does not mean that the food supply goes down. We just make more food. We're smart people. Malthus had no concept of that. Yet, Paul Ehrlich, based on bogus 19th century science, publishes The Population Bomb in 1968 saying, yeah, we're all going to die. The population is getting too big. We need to eradicate some. We need to stop it. That fear of overpopulation to this day motivates people like Bill Gates. Right? It's an unbelievably bad science, yet we are sterilizing populations around the world. Like, one of Bill Gates' big things is to go sterilize all the moms in Africa. Unbelievably racist, ridiculous, bad science to try and stop one of the few, frankly, cultures that's above the current. Do you realize in America we no longer are reproducing enough to keep the population where it is? Most of the populations in the world now are on the edge of demographic collapse. China, Japan's in huge trouble. Europe's gone. America has now reached, for a long time, we stayed up. But now, in 50, 100 years, the population is going to be way lower than it is, unless cultures like Africa and India continue to have kids. Unfortunately, America, through organizations like Gates, the Gates Foundation, is over there tying, and this is how they use their money, by the way, tying their financial aid. So they'll go into a country. They'll go into an African country. They'll go to the government. They'll say, hey, you could use some infrastructure. You could use some money for roads or whatever it is, hospitals. And the government's like, yeah, we could use some money. Who doesn't want money, right? But here's what you have to do. You have to make sure that everyone is getting the birth control pill or sterilized. It has to be in your schools. We have to be pushing this on your kids. African culture is very not that, right? African culture, they love mothers and they love having kids, and the culture doesn't want it. But the government officials, and again, this is always, I'm going to mention this more later, this is always a top-down movement. This is never a grassroots movement. It's always rich ideologues pushing it on the rest of the people, okay? This whole trans thing, complete rich ideologues pushing it on the rest of us. The little people pay the price. Well, Paul Ehrlich's pseudo-scientific nonsense about the population bomb, which has been debunked again and again, is still to this day causing all sorts of problems. Another propagandist of the time, a lot of these I talk about, not a lot of them, but Helen Gurley Brown, and I'll just put a quick plug in. Helen Gurley Brown and Betty Friedan take a big portion of this film, Unprotected, and the propaganda that they do. She was a secretary for a long time, who married into, in L.A., she married a movie producer, a guy who had money, and he convinced her to write a little book called Sex and the Single Girl, which claimed to purport just how much fun it was to be a woman who was promiscuous and how much of a drag it would be to get married and settle down and not be able to be literally a sex object. Sex and the Single Girl sold millions and millions of copies the moment it was released. It was quickly made into a film. Cary Grant became a major cultural milestone in the early 1960s. The sexual objectification of women became the thing to want. She literally said, Helen Gurley Brown, like, what do you want to be? I want to be a sex object. If somebody doesn't look at me as a sex object, I have failed for the day. So she taught young girls how to pretty themselves up so that the boss might flirt with you. She taught young girls how to manipulate husbands and get them away from their wives. This girl, through Sex and the City, of course, is the more recent iteration of this on HBO, based on the 1960s version of Sex and the Single Girl. There's even a later version now. There's a new Sex and the City out. This is all based on Helen Gurley Brown's complete fabrication. She actually, as far as we can tell, I mean, if you ask her, well, what's the best thing in life? She says there's three best things in life. There's sex. Like that was it. But actually, she stayed married to the same guy. She was just chilling for money. Later, Cosmopolitan magazine, which was a literary journal in the 50s, 40s, 50s, early 60s, she became editor of Cosmopolitan because it was either hire Helen Gurley Brown or end the magazine. So they hired her to the ground. She said, let me do what I want to do with the magazine. And she made it into basically a sex mag for young women. It's explicitly what it was. It became the most popular magazine in the world. Sold millions of copies every week, by far the highest selling magazine on the planet. Completely devoted to making sex objects of women. Nothing else. So they would tell stories about how great it was. They had a story about how great it was to be a high-class call girl in New York City. One of the more famous ones. It was written by Tina Brown, who became the Page Six writer in the New York Times back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, even up into the 2000s, very famous. And one time they asked Tina Brown, well, what about that high-class call girl? And you know what Tina Brown says? I just made that up. I didn't know any high-class call girls. What am I? I'm not going out talking to prostitutes. Are you kidding? I made up the complete story. I interview a woman who worked for Cosmopolitan in this film, and she said, yeah, Helen Gurley Brown had rules. She explicitly explained to all of her writers how to make up the best stories that would have the highest impact, sell magazines. It did not have anything to do with facts. So you would, we need to reach people in Omaha. Okay, so yeah, let's not place all of our stories in New York City, but they have to be glamorous. So how about the young farm girl gets a trip to Paris, and there she meets a man on the Champs-Élysées, and they have a romantic evening, and he takes her back to his hotel room, and they make mad passionate love, and in the morning she's in love and infatuated, and everything's great. Yeah, okay, that sounds great. Did that person exist? Absolutely not. They just made every single story up, okay? Complete sham. There was no Cosmo Girl. Yet, that today is basically the template for every Instagram post that young girls make. This makes me happy. Every girl looking at Cosmo said, yeah, this is the high life, right? I don't want to be home raising kids. That's boring. I want to go sell my body and have a romantic relationship. Complete lie. Propaganda. The propaganda continues. I mean, it just continues throughout. I threw a couple of these. This is just from decades. Pleasantville was a movie back in the, I think, 90s. Pretty interesting film, actually. I like the way it's made, but completely demonic. The premise, anybody seen Pleasantville? Okay. The premise is that two young kids in contemporary times, but with a rough upbringing, not even so much, but they get pulled back into, the guy likes watching 50s black and white, like Leave It to Beaver type shows, right? They get pulled into that black and white world through the TV. And they find themselves in the black and white world. And what they realize when they get back to the pro-family 1950s, which, I mean, as I hope I've kind of shown, wasn't exactly all that pro-family. That also was a bit of propaganda. But they get back into the pro-family, black and white 50s, and it's just, everybody's just so hypocritical and terrible, and life is not at all like it's just shown on TV. And these people are just miserable with their restrictive family values, and what they need to do is just have a little bit more promiscuous sex. And so the girl who, Reese Witherspoon there, when she was a youngster, she's probably still a teenager when she did this, she goes and seduces one of the high school kids. And when she does, she gets him in the back seat of the convertible, as you would in the 50s, and she seduces him and has sex, and they turn into color. And so as the various characters fulfill their animalistic desires, they turn from black and white into color. Pretty unique, like allegorical piece of propaganda, really. It's also exactly the opposite of the truth, right? Like, no, you are not happy having sex in the backseat of the car. You wake up the next day feeling miserable and used. I talked to a young girl who we don't actually show her face in the film, but she explains very clearly what college hookup culture is like. Okay, she lived it. And she didn't want to show her film because she didn't want her dad to know what it was all like when he sent her off to school. But I asked her in the phone, I asked her explicitly, so what happens on the morning after? Like a girl's dorm the morning after, there's been a bunch of hookups the night before. Like, is everybody happy? They're all like, it's a fun thing. Like, they're all, ooh, wasn't that fun? She's like, absolutely not. Everybody, if they're not, first of all, they're all hungover because they had to get completely wasted in order to go through with that. But when they wake up, they say, oh, that was horrible. They feel terrible. They try to joke about it to make themselves feel better, but everybody's miserable. It's just the bottom line. It's all a lie. And then we move into the more, this we'll talk about next talk more, but the pro-gay propaganda then comes on board. So we probably don't have as strong of a gay movement if in the 90s we don't have shows like Will and Grace. And what does Will and Grace show? Oh, just how happy all the homosexuals are. Right? They're just so thrilled with life. They're just so normal like the rest of us, yet not even like the rest of us, they're better. They actually have a happier life. That's why we have the term gay, isn't it? Right? All lies. The homosexual lifestyle is painful and unhealthy and misery-making. Modern Family, another example. It's non-stop propaganda and lies. The scientific, the pro-science, pro-rationalist side uses these kind of tools. How can we respond to that? How do we respond to the fake science of propaganda? Obviously, you can't believe everything you see and hear. I mean, just you got to be skeptical like us Gen Xers, okay? You just have to accept that the world's lying to you most of the time. It just is. I'm sorry, it just is. People are lying to you most of the time. If it's coming from the media, especially, it's probably false. This is why at the beginning of COVID, and I respect various views, I get it, but I believe it was people like our Gen X generation at the beginning of COVID, like I was one day in, I'm like, absolutely not, absolutely not. This thing is garbage and I'm not going for it. I don't want to say, I don't want to be prideful about it, but my generation, we've been skeptical about this stuff for a long time. And so you'll see the younger generation hasn't been educated in propaganda and nonsense. And the older generation, I'm sorry to say, was a little bit more trusting of the government. They didn't see all the long-term effects. Like, we were a pro-science group, right? But no, you just got to say, like, this, you're selling me nonsense. So you can't believe it. Don't be afraid to do the research. Don't be afraid to also, by the way, proclaim the truth. Like, we're not afraid of the science as believers. The actual science, the actual evidence. Yeah, let's look into what the homosexual lifestyle is actually like. Yeah, let's look into the effects of abortion and the birth control pill. Let's look at the science of all these things. Let's look at the sham science of orgone accumulators and all of this stuff. Let's look at what psychologists actually say. Let's look at the counseling industry and see if it's actually doing any sort of good. Like, let's look at the evidence and actually come to conclusions. Most of what you see now has actually moved toward the more spiritualist side. I talked to a mother the other day whose kid was in medical school. She's like, I know he told me this. I still can't believe it, except that it was my kid, so I got to believe it. They're in medical school looking at a cadaver, and they couldn't come to a conclusion about what sex the cadaver was in medical school. What? This is superstitious nonsense, right? I mean, this is pagan spiritualism. This is not hard science. And as it comes together, what you see is science now absolutely moving towards a more spiritualist, superstitious viewpoint, because the science actually doesn't back them up. And then let me end with this one, just to put in almost a shameless plug here as well. Tell true stories in a compelling way. One of the reasons that the satanic attack on the family has had such success is that they know how to tell the stories. Like Cosmopolitan and all these films and all these movies. I mean, I actually watch almost exclusively older television now with my kids, because there's not a gay character every other second. Today, you can't watch one television show without a fake gay character. And it's all lies. You guys, if you know, study what happens in gay culture. Study a lifestyle of a kid who goes in the Midwest off to San Francisco to live in the Castro district. It's misery. It's disease. It's drug addiction. It's nasty. It kills people. Those are the stories, actually, we need to tell. People don't want to listen, but we can do it. And I think we can do it in a creative way. We have the best stories. We have the proper stories. We just need to be able to tell them and not be afraid to tell them. And not even just the bad stories, but the good ones. I mean, that's the reason I do films. One, people watch films. But if you watch my documentaries, they're very story-based. It's not like lecture-based. It's just one story after another, and they all come together into one big story. We should be able to do that. I would argue not even with documentaries, though, but we got to be producing actual narrative stories. And we're doing this a little bit better. But I will say, as a filmmaker, it's tough to find money to do it. So if you find someone, you know, like myself, just off the top, who's out there trying to make film, I put this one up there. This is a project that I'm trying to get going called Libertyville. Why did I call it Libertyville? Because it's a free, right? That goes with the whole theme of the weekend here. It's a town called Libertyville where theoretically people get to go and, like America, live out your every whim and desire, right? But what does that actually look like? And the story concept I have now actually puts it sort of in a concept of a modern-day Sodom and Gomorrah concept, where the volcano you see in the back is going to erupt and end it, and what are we going to do with that? And it's sort of, I don't know if you... I haven't seen all of Yellowstone, but I feel like it's sort of in that style where you've got multiple generations and multiple stories. But here's the thing. It tells the truth about each of these lives. So the Instagram, the teenager who's selling OnlyFans videos in my story is not going to be a bastion of happiness, right? We will get to see just how hard and painful that life is. So I would encourage us to support those kind of projects, and I'm glad to talk to any of you about that if you want. So don't believe the lies, tell good stories, and in the next talk, we'll get to a little bit more about practically some other tips for what we can do. Let us take a break. Hold on. Oh, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, so I've been talking about unprotected just because it matched our talk today. This goes through Helen Gurley Brown, Betty Friedan, and Margaret Sanger, and that whole movement, the feminist movement, and specifically it's tied to the birth control pill and the pornography that resulted and all of that in a narrative form. It tells the story of a couple of college girls and who found love. It also, if you enjoyed the first talk last night about the nature of love and God's plan for the family, that story also gets told in here. So I highly recommend this one. I may have a few more copies out in the back. And there's some that don't have this cover. They have the Ignatius Press cover, but it's exactly the same film, and it has Spanish subtitles. That's the only difference. We sold it a little bit differently to various people. Disconnected is the story of the transgender explosion. This is what we'll talk about more this next talk coming up. But this tells the story again of young girls who are trapped in the nonsense and the pseudoscientific. I took my high schoolers to the opening of this, and they all love it. Show it to your parents, your kids, everybody. This, How to Talk to a Skeptic, is a mix of, I would say it's a mix of theology and apologetics tips. So a lot of practical tips for talking with your skeptical, as in non-believing friends, family, coworkers, but also a whole section in the middle, which kind of is my favorite section, about some of the theological issues that we need to deal with. And then at the end, some, like there's a section in here on sex at the end that's very similar to the talk from last night as well. So pick up that book as well.